Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for May 26, 2013. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, and joining me as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Well, good evening, sir.
And a little later in the show, probably about 10 minutes, we're going to have our special guest, David Mark, of Politics, and that's with an X, and he has been with many other political media sources before that, and we get David on the line, I'll let him go through some of that at that time, and you'll just be like, wow, this guy's got such experience. How did you ever land him on the Kudzu Vine? but until then, we're going to talk about some more very local politics for Tim and I. This show started as a Georgia-based show. We're still based in Georgia, but we just talk about stuff all over the South and the country. But it's real funny. When we started out, we actually, before the first show went on the air, I offered this up to the Democratic Party of Georgia to kind of be like their show. My concept was for me or me and Tim to do it maybe with some people that worked in the party. At that time, different people than now said, you know, maybe that's not best, David. We don't want to limit you. We want you to have the freedom to say what you want. And the people that we're about to talk about now might say, well, I wish they would have gone another way. This past week, the Democratic Party of Georgia got hit about three ways. The chairman, Mike Berline, had a reprimand, I believe, with a fine levied by the State Bar Association. And that's a lot of that's his personal dealings as a lawyer, not necessarily involved politics. But then another lawyer who's also a DNC member and a past chair, David Worley, feels it does reflect on the Democratic Party of Georgia, and he called on Mike Berline to step down. And then Catherine, which may be on in a minute with us, she did a post on Blog for Democracy, which was picked up by Peach Pundit, that showed that the Democratic Party of Georgia has about $20,000 cash on hand, with the exception of like a few days after the election when, you know, you spend all the money up, probably the worst financial shape the Democratic Party of Georgia has been in anybody's memory. I'm sure there were days when $20,000 might have gone a lot further that they had less, but in today's dollars, they've probably never been in worse shape at this point in a cycle, because if you know about politics, you're supposed to rake in cash when elections aren't going on so you can spend it closer to election day. Tim, I've thrown out a lot. Give me some of your takes here.
Well, I think probably the most damning thing in all of this is the fact that David Worley, who's well thought of in the party and has been for many, many years, you and I have both known David for a long time. You actually worked for him in his campaign, and he was one of our early supporters up here when we reorganized the party nearly 20 years ago, and now he is going to the executive committee and ask them to formally recommend that Mr. Chair Berline be ousted by the full membership. This is bad. We know we were just talking about what happened over there in Alabama. The state, you know, the state party is broke. They're in a big split and all this and that and the other. And I've been trying to tiptoe around this. I mean, I personally like Mike. I know a lot of other people that are involved in this. So do you. I know that many members of the executive committee, a lot of the state party committee members listen to this show, and I'm just going to have to say it. If we're to the point where the chairman of the Democratic Party of Georgia is hurting this party publicly, and I think now that all of this coming to light is hurting the party publicly at a time when we're about to have somebody like Michelle Nunn, you know, enter a high-profile open race, at a time when the state party is broke, essentially, at a time when recruitment is, by any stretch of the imagination, not going well, at a time when the grassroots are in disarray because the state party is in disarray. I'm just going to have to say it. I believe it's time for Chairman Berlon to submit his resignation.
Yeah, and I actually pulled up Catherine's post from the 21st, about 5 days ago, and it shows actually the ending cash on hand. Now, there could be some outstanding payments. Maybe that's where I found the 20,000-some-odd figure. But it says just under 31,000. So, you know, I'll admit my first number was wrong, according to Catherine's report. But the bigger problem is it shows that the Republican Party has $632,000 cash on hand. So, you know, over 20 times the amount of money. Although, you know, they are the majority party, you would expect that they would have more, but not that much more in a state that if you just look at top-line races, this is a 45 or 48, 55, 53 state. I mean, it's much closer than that as far as, you know, the actual vote on particularly like the presidential race. So it should be, you know, the money shouldn't be that big a disparity. So if you're talking about, you know, dollars to actually, you know, fight in the campaign to the ballot box, the Democratic Party is at a huge disadvantage. What are some ways, Tim, you think the Democratic Party of Georgia could begin to raise the money? I mean, is the old school event with Frank Ski going to do it?
Yeah, I don't know about that. But the first thing you got to do is reach out to the donor base. They're still there. There's people in this county that I live in that have given more money to the state party than the state party presently has in their treasury over the years. I wonder when the last time is anyone asked these people for a donation to the state party. When is the last time we've seen anybody you know, doing the field work in these counties? When is the last time that the state party had like this high profile event that made all the news and this and that and the other? This brings up another question. If Mike Berlon is voted out of office or if he should resign, who would then replace him?
I guess they'd have an election. You'd have an election. You'd have to, you know, figure out.
I understand the process, but who could that person be? Who could step up to the plate now? I'm talking about a high-profile individual and straighten this out.
Well, you just need somebody that was a doer, that could accomplish things, that had a lot of time on their hands. Because to me, that's one thing. If you look at, if somebody, you know, is in a stage of life where they still need to have a job, run a business, you know, have a legal career, have whatever kind of career, they just don't have the time to dedicate. Because at this point in the, you know, our political life cycle of whatever state you're in, being state party chair of a state the size of Georgia, which is the 10th largest state population-wise, it's just too big a job to, you know, be a part-time job, at least if you don't have lots of money. Now, if you have a party that has, you know, lots of money and therefore you can hire a robust staff, that's a different situation. That's just not the case. Well, I think we're time to put this aside and transfer to a lot of more national politics. And right now our guest David Mark joins us. Welcome, David.
Good to be with you.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, good to have you on the Kudzu Vine. Now, David, I've known you for, gosh, about 10 years going back to Campaign Elections Magazine. But for those that don't know you through all these different things you've done, give us a little bit about your background. You can talk about pre-political work if you need to and just bring us up to the current point.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on the show, and thanks for remembering those days back at campaigns and elections. A lot has changed in the campaign world just in the last decade or so, online fundraising, activism, all that. But I've been a political journalist in one form or another for most of my career, going back about 15 years or so now. I started off as a local reporter in my hometown in Southern California. Then I moved to D.C. I was a reporter on Capitol Hill for CQ. Then I moved over to Campaigns and Elections Magazine. And at that point in my career, about 10 years ago, I kind of moved away from being a daily reporter to being an editor, analyst, that sort of thing. And I did that for several years. While I was there, I wrote a book called Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. Then I heard about a startup that was coming on board in 2006, and I was fortunate to be hired under what became Politico. And I was there for 6 years from the very start. And then just this past August, about 9 months ago, I moved back to the West Coast where I'm from, and I'm now editor of a site, politics.topics.com, both with an X, which is a fun political discussion forum. We have original content, and we really encourage people to get active in the news and state their views. And we're based in Silicon Valley, though I still get back to Washington, D.C. a fair amount.
Yes, well, you've probably been in with some of the most exciting things happening with online political journalism, because, of course, Politico, I guess, is one of the top sites. And I believe you did the Arena section of that site, which was where you would get all kind of leading political thinkers and kind of throw a topic out there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. We would have all kinds of folks, sometimes sitting members of Congress. We had former elected officials, members of Congress, and governors. We had pundits, strategists, consultants, both left and right, Democratic and Republican. And we would have people comment on the news of the day, even of the moment. And it was a lot of fun to do, to get this kind of mashup of different opinions. And it's kind of funny because there was a crowdsourcing element in which you would throw out a topic about, say, an open Senate seat race or a House race, and you get people who really knew about it. Either they lived in the district or they'd worked with that candidate or something like that. And so it really crowdsourced a lot of new information, and it's fun to do for several years.
Yes. Well, let's go ahead and move on to your current, employer, politics.topics. And that seems to be a lot where people, just everybody, can give their opinion. There's a lot of polling-based issue topics. Tell us about what's going on there, what you do, and what's your vision for that news source.
Right. As I mentioned, what we're trying to do is really get people to join in the discussion forums. A lot of sites say they want to do this, but we're really aimed at having user thoughts about political issues to be the main source of content. Now, we do write all our original content. It's all written by staff or sometimes guest posts from op-eds. But what we're really trying to do is spur discussion. And so unlike other sites, each story ends with a question mark. What do you think about what was said in the story? Do you agree about this or that? And we really give people a chance to go off and create a political profile of their own online. And that really is the ultimate vision, to make it kind of like a Facebook of politics, though somewhat different, but so where people can really have their own profile of what they think about any number of different issues. And the site's been around just for about 15 months or so, since early March 2012, and I started in August last year. So it's still relatively new and growing out, but it's picking up steam and then doing pretty well so far.
Sounds good. Well, I'm on here with my co-host, Tim Shiflett. I want to pass it over to Tim in case he has questions about politics, the site, and then from there we're going to talk about some national and regional political topics with you.
Sounds great. Look forward to it.
Good evening, David, and thank you for being on the show with us tonight. Hope things
My
are going
pleasure.
Well on the West Coast. Okay. One of the first things I saw when I went to your site was a post which the question was asked, do you trust polls? Well, 79% of the respondents said they do not. Who are these people? Are they representative of the country at large? Are these the political people telling you that? Is it just an internet thing? What's going on with that particular thing there?
By and large, they are not political people. They're not insiders or consultants or people who do politics professionally. They're just people who are interested citizens and get their news from a variety of sources. And in a way, I was not surprised to see that answer, because people get really distrustful of polls, particularly if it gives them a result they don't agree with. If they're a Republican and the poll result favors the Democrat, they say, well, we don't trust that methodology, and vice versa. It goes both ways. And the tricky thing with polls is I would always advise you don't want to believe any single poll, because we've seen them off so many times. In fact, recently in the South, in South Carolina, in the Mark Sanford race, there was just one poll that actually showed his Democratic opponent up by 9 points a few days before the election, and we know how that turned out. So I think people have to be careful. I think you have to combine polls, look at a broad range of them, and then sort of take the average of all the polling results you get.
Yeah. Do you think people, especially in the last presidential race, really made that mistake in a big way by honing in on one or two polls and saying, look here, Mitt Romney is winning this thing, we don't care what anyone else says? Do you think a lot of people made that mistake?
Absolutely. And I think this is an area where people get blinded by their own ideology. A lot of liberals end up just watching MSNBC and listening to left-wing radio and seeing their own sites. And same thing on the right, where you get conservatives who just hear what they want to on Fox and other sources. And I watch all those. I like them all, but I think you've got to have a broad range of media that you take in. And what we really started to see in the latter days of the presidential campaign was kind of a war on pollsters, and really oftentimes conservatives questioning the methodology of pollsters. And it just didn't really work very well, because remember, pollsters, they're in business. They have every incentive to be accurate and not skew the polls. They want to get hired again. So that line of argument never really made much sense to me.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you one more question about your site, and I'm going to throw it back to David, and I'm sure we'll go back and forth a little bit on different topics.
Sure.
But you have stated that you moved back to the West Coast. Is there a difference in maintaining a national site like this on the West Coast as opposed to, you know, Washington, D.C., New York, somewhere like that? Is there any difference that you've noticed?
There is, and it's both good and bad. I think the positive is you really get a different perspective on things, where not everybody's so wrapped up in politics and they have other things that they do on weekends. It's not their obsession, and I think that's really helpful for getting a different perspective. I feel I'm able to keep up with my sources in D.C. and elsewhere pretty well, and so in that way I feel like we're fairly plugged in. But undoubtedly, there is somewhat of a downside in that you don't just see people around town and run into them at parties and even on the metro or sometimes on the streets of Washington, D.C., in the Capitol building, et cetera. And that is a difference. My goal is to get back to D.C. fairly often. I was just there for almost 2 weeks earlier this month, and I plan to go again in early July and keep a presence there. We also do have a staff writer in the Washington, D.C. area, so she kind of represents us at press conferences and other events and such. So we do have a presence there, but no doubt it is a bit of a challenge.
All right. Thank you for that, sir. David?
Yes. Well, David, I was looking at your site both when I booked you a few weeks ago and in preparation for tonight and even today. And I looked at a lot of your topic or your questions, if you will, and you do a good job of being very neutral in how you word the questions. Yet a lot of your respondents seem to be overwhelmingly conservative. It's not like you're leading them to that direction, but for whatever reason, it looks like the folks that seem to vote on the site tend to be much more conservative than other polls would show. Why do you think more conservatives are getting into either your site or at least answering questions on your site?
It's a good question. It's something, honestly, that we try and think through each day, because we do want it to be neutral, and we try not to have the questions be leading. We want them to be provocative, but we want the people to not think that we're waiting the answer one way or another. The short answer, though, is it actually has somewhat to do with our parent site, Topics, T-O-P-I-X. It's the largest local discussion forum in the country. It has about 12.5 million users or so, and it tends to be more weighted in Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, and in that region where there are more conservative folks. So I think there's some migration over to our site, but that doesn't explain everything. And I think a lot of conservatives feel kind of disaffected by the mainstream media. I think it's one of the reasons why Fox has grown in popularity to such a degree. So it's a challenge we have. There's no doubt about it. But I think the more time that we're out there, hopefully we can draw a more ideologically balanced audience. More than hopefully, that's part of our strategy. And slowly but surely, I think it's going in that direction.
Yes, this is a quite interesting dynamic here. We've got a guy that works out and lives in San Francisco, but yet the site that you're based out of takes its intellectual center from Appalachia. I doubt you would find too many times that would happen.
It's pretty interesting. We have probably a core group of users, probably 30-plus people who chime in on virtually every question. And, yeah, many of them are in Appalachia. Some of them are actually in more liberal regions like Boulder, Colorado, and a few other spots. But it is an interesting dynamic. And there are some issues that really get people emotional. They really get them talking, like gun control and all the discussion of that issue in recent months. Marijuana legalization is something that gets people quite animated. And I would say it's a conservative crowd, but more of a libertarian crowd than anything else. You actually get a lot of Ron Paul types, at least on foreign policy and also drug legalization. A lot of the users are not very enthusiastic, for instance, about U.S. involvement in Syria and other overseas adventures. So I'd say it's more libertarian at this point than conservative.
Okay. Well, let's get into some of those issues. And one that really seems to have a divide on, if people even pay attention to it, is Benghazi. David, why do you think that this seems to not really be getting traction with the average swing voter? I mean, it's something in talk radio on the conservative side that's huge and on conservative sites, but beyond people that just, you know, hate President Obama or Democrats, the average voter just doesn't seem to even understand it, seemingly.
Yeah, I think the problem the Republicans have had here is trying to tie this issue directly to President Obama or the White House. And there's been a lot of talk about and focus on process issues, like who said what in the talking points that UN Ambassador Susan Rice was given. And most people just don't care that much. They're not that into the weeds. They're just simply not all that interested. So I think there's also, frankly, a benefit of the doubt the president gets on foreign policy. And I think the view is that they tried the best they could to deal with it. It was a chaotic situation in Libya. And as tragic as it was, there's probably not a lot could have been done to prevent it. I'm not necessarily agreeing with that point of view, but I just think Republicans have not been able to tie this directly to the Obama White House. And until that kind of thing happens, it might be tough for them to get traction.
Yes. Well, and talking about another scandal, one I think the average voter understands better because it's easier to understand, but still, according to the polling, has not attached itself to the president. But I do think it actually has more traction just as an issue, and that's the IRS targeting scandal. Why has it not attached to President Obama, or do you think it has more potential too?
I think it has potential in that this is a federal agency that ultimately answers to the executive office of the president of the United States himself. So far, though, there's not a lot of similarly to Benghazi, there's not direct linkages into the White House. The closest Republicans have been able to come is the White House counsel, a woman named by the name of Kathleen Ruemmler. I doubt one in 1,000 people could identify who the White House counsel is. And she certainly knew something about this, but until something can be tied directly to President Obama, I think it's awfully tough to do for Republicans to get more traction on this. Part of the problem, too, is that it's really difficult to fire people in the federal government. I know from all those years in Washington, in fact, there's only two IRS employees, the commissioner and I think the inspector general, could actually be fired. Even this woman, Lois Lerner, who was the head of this tax-exempt arm of the IRS, the most that could be done to her is be placed on administrative leave, in which she still gets paid. I think that frustrates a lot of people. The problem Republicans have is they haven't uncovered a lot of new facts, and until that happens, I think they run the risk of looking like they're overdoing it and just being ultra-partisan, and they may want to rein that in at some point.
I think if they continue to focus on these kind of issues and not maybe the economy things that they have, a better chance to get traction, they're not going to help their party's electoral chances. Well, obviously, Tim's already asked you some questions. I'm going to turn it back over to Tim to ask you some more issue-based questions, and then it may come back over to me again.
Sure.
Tim?
Okay. We, of course, are already looking ahead to the presidential race in 2016. Probably mainly because of one name, that of Hillary Clinton. So I've got to ask you, if Hillary Clinton does run for president, do you think she scares off most of the big names on the GOP side, or is there an A-list type candidate who is saying, you know what, I can beat her, and how would they do it?
Yeah, first of all, I'm not convinced she's going to run. She certainly would seem to have the Democratic nomination at her asking, but of course we saw that in 2008. And she may be tired. There may be other family factors. I'm not convinced she will, but let's just assume she does, which of course is a real possibility. I think she would claim the Democratic nomination fairly easily. On the Republican side, it's interesting. There are all kinds of candidates, each have a lot going for them, but each has some major drawbacks as well. The one I kind of think would be best for the political environment as it's coming up now is Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana. The guy is brilliant, Rhodes Scholar, was head of the state health system before that. He's a real policy wonk. He's not exactly a dynamic public speaker, but he would also give the Republicans some real diversity. He's Indian-American. And I think he'd be a really interesting candidate. As far as we know, there aren't any scandals or anything like that that could hurt him. Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, is oft mentioned. I'm a little bit less bullish on him. He's a great speaker. I've heard him several times. He's really forceful and dynamic. He's obviously taken the lead on the immigration bill in the Senate. He's got some personal issues back in Florida, some financial and other matters that came up a bit in his 2010 Senate race and probably could come up again in 2016. Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, he's sort of on the outs now with a lot of conservatives because of his ties with President Obama late in the 2012 campaign. He might be the Republicans' best shot, but I don't think any of these candidates would inevitably lose to Hillary Clinton. And remember, Mitt Romney still got 47% of the vote running what I call a pretty bad campaign. I think even a lot of Republicans might agree with that. And so the Republicans are going to be competitive. Can they put together a coalition that's going to bring in more women, minorities, et cetera, Hispanics? That's the challenge right now.
Mm-hmm. Does a candidate like Hillary Clinton break through in a big way down here in a state like Georgia?
It's interesting. Georgia is a state that was mentioned by the Obama campaign in 2012 as sort of a test case. They mused about both Georgia and Arizona, both of which they ended up losing, but not by as much as you would think. Georgia is an interesting test case and that, of course, there's a strong conservative Republican base, but there is a sizable African-American population in Atlanta and elsewhere in the state. Interestingly, there's also a growing number of Hispanic voters in Georgia, which is not a place you might always associate with a lot of Hispanic voters. So it's conceivable that a candidate like Hillary Clinton or another Democrat running for president could nearly string together the liberal white vote, the minority vote, women, et cetera, and eke out a victory. I think that's going to be tough in 2016. The demographics are changing enough that maybe by 2020 or 2024 that could happen. I still think that would be a hard slog, though, in 2016.
Okay, and of course, next month, you know, we're all about the real votes. Next month, we're going to have some real votes in a statewide race. That everybody's going to be watching, and of course I'm talking about the Massachusetts special election.
Right.
Of course, we have the specter of Scott Brown hanging over this race. And so I have two questions, companion questions. What is your take on this race, where it stands now, and could we have a repeat of 2010 here?
I think it's unlikely that Democrats would get taken by surprise again, as happened with Scott Brown in 2010, early 2010, when the Republican inexplicably or surprisingly won that race. I think Democrats realize that it's a closer state than they had expected, and they put a lot more focus and resources into it. Having said that, the Democratic candidate is Ed Markey. He's a longtime congressman. He's been in office 35 years plus in the House of Representatives. Now he's running for Senate in the special election, and he's not exactly a world-beating candidate. He hasn't had a lot of campaign appearances. He kind of looks like he's almost taking it for granted and hiding from the media. And he's pretty darn liberal as well. But the Republican nominee, Gabriel Gomez, he has had some verbal missteps, and it is still a Democratic state, so I would fully expect the Democrats to hold on to the seat. But it could be closer than they wanted to. It's been a pretty ugly campaign. There's actually been very little focus on substance. It's mostly been about name-calling between the two candidates. So I think Democrats will hold on, but it might be closer than many would like.
And why did this race go negative?
Because I think both sides realize it's going to be relatively low turnout, and this is, as you know, this is what can often happen in low turnout elections, where you probably can't persuade a lot of people. So what you're trying to do is just go for that small group who's actually likely to turn out on election day. And many people are motivated by negative messages about politicians. They don't really have a lot of faith in elected officials and campaigners, candidates to begin with. So I think the view is if they can just turn out a relatively small group of voters and keep others home, that's probably enough to win the election.
And a final question on this, and then I'm going to send it back to David. Does this type of race, this negative campaigning, who does it favor?
Probably, in this case, favors the candidate with more name recognition, and that would be Ed Markey, this longtime congressman. As I said, he's been in the House since the late 1970s. Because it's a relatively compressed time frame, he has more money, he has more name recognition, so he can just kind of run up the votes that way. If this were, say, a full two-year cycle for the Senate seat, that would be a different matter. But in this case, I do think it's the person who's almost a quasi-incumbent, Ed Markey, since he's been a congressman for so long, and his opponent has never held elective office.
Okay, thank you, sir. David?
Yes, well, David, let's talk about maybe two more topics for you while we still have you on the air. We're a Southern-based political show, so it's very rare that we get to talk about Toronto politics or crackers. But thanks to Jezebel, we get a chance to do that. And I did search your site, and I noticed that y'all did a question on it. And it's one of the more evenly divided questions, but you worded it very differently as, can he survive the scandal? Not, do you think Rob Ford, Toronto mayor, smoked crack? Just as a political journalist, how do you have to handle a question like this, which was brought by Cyclops Bell, which is probably not the – it has more of a TMZ-ish feel to it, and they actually tried to buy the videotape by raising money. How do you seriously handle a question like this as a journalist?
Well, I think the fact which you just described, the whole news gathering process here, kind of gave this mayor of Toronto a defense. He was this guy, Rob Ford, the mayor. He gave a very kind of legalistic defense. He says, I don't smoke crack or something to that effect. It was kind of a Clintonian answer where it left open all kinds of wiggle room about whether he had in the past, or he said, I don't presently use cocaine or something of that matter. I think what you try and do in that case is kind of impugn the integrity of the news gatherers, and the fact that they're trying to buy this tape doesn't exactly speak to their journalistic values very well. So I think that's about the most he can do, and sort of just hope the story goes away unless there's some proof or evidence. The problem now is he's essentially got to prove a negative. He's got to say, I did not do this, and that's a position you never want to be in politics. So I think he's handled it about as well as he can, but if there's a tape out there that does exist, he's in big trouble.
Yeah, now if he were to, let's say the tape comes out and it shows that he's smoking crack, of course Marion Barry comes to mind. Now that was, nearly 20 years ago when that happened. If somehow he survives this, somebody could say, well, look, the white guy got away with it and the black guy didn't. But you could also say it's 20 years later, although, you know, crack is crack. I mean, that's a pretty hardcore drug, probably on the top shelf of hardcore drugs, if you will. What do you think the lesson would be if he were to survive, if it was proven that he did smoke crack?
I think it would be, you've got to tell the truth. If you think at all there's any evidence out there, you better be careful. And I think a good example of this is Anthony Weiner, the former congressman from New York, remember, who resigned in disgrace in that Twitter scandal, is now running for New York City mayor. And he said openly, you know what, there might be more pictures out there. I don't know. And you really got to be open about that kind of fact, and you hope that it doesn't come up. And if it is going to emerge, let people know, give them some heads up. I think that's one of the reasons why Mark Sanford was able to revive his political career, in that people knew what he had done as governor, and that was several years ago, and no kind of new information emerged about it. In fact, he was utterly open about it. He even had his fiance out with him on the campaign trail, and that way he was just open about it. So I think you just have to tell people what the situation is and try and hope that they respect that.
Okay. Well, let's move back over to the East Coast, where you used to reside in the area, and that would be Virginia politics. The GOP had a convention, and Ken Cuccinelli, we kind of knew he was going to be the gubernatorial nominee, and he's, you know, fairly conservative, but he's not, you know, shock value conservative, if you will. Now, the rest of the ticket got some people, including the lieutenant governor nominee, that would be a shock value conservative, including him comparing Planned Parenthood to the Ku Klux Klan. But that's not the only one. And, of course, I guess it just came out today, John Warner, the former Republican senator, said he won't endorse the ticket. Basically, this should be an easier election for a lot of Republicans to win in Virginia because, for whatever reason, Terry McAuliffe just doesn't resonate with Virginia voters, and this is an odd or an off-year election, which seems to be better for Republicans, but somehow they're managing to screw this up. Are they going to, you know, blow this thing, or is Terry McAuliffe just too disconnected with Virginians?
It's pretty close. It's a close call to see if he's too disconnected with Virginians. I fully agree. He's not very popular. He kind of comes across as a slick political salesman type guy, which is kind of what he is. He's been open about that in his political career. To me, this whole campaign is a bit of a disappointment, in that I used to work in Virginia, spent a lot of time there, and it's a great state, and feel like they could do better on both places between Terry McAuliffe and Ken Cuccinelli. I think it's going to be a real nail biter, though. The Democratic machine is amped up to defeat Attorney General Cuccinelli because of his rather controversial views. And as you say, he's actually a fairly mainstream conservative. He's just been so vocal about a certain few issues and really pressed them as Attorney General. He's engendered a lot of dislike on the Democratic side. Virginia is also a changing state. President Obama won it 2 times in a row. There are now 2 Democratic senators there. Although the House delegation is strongly Republican, 8-3, and the legislature is still Republican. So it's kind of a politically schizophrenic state. It goes both ways. And I think this one's going to be down to the wire. It's really tough to say who might come out on top of this.
Okay. Well, David, before I let you go, what do you kind of have planned for politics in the next few weeks or months that may not be live yet that you can tell us about?
You know, what we're really looking to get online soon is user-generated content in which people can come up with their own articles and have people comment on that. We're running tests on that. It's a bit of a dicey situation. To be blunt, you don't want to turn over editorial control completely because you never know what people are going to put up. But we really found there's a certain crowdsourcing element. And, you know, we work really hard to get a variety of stories up there people want to comment on. But we have a small staff, and we can't see everything. So we're working on ways to let people come in, chime in with their own voices, and put up the topics that they want to discuss.
Yes. Any chance you bring something similar to the arena to politics?
We're thinking about that. We're working something through something on that where we could have maybe a panel of experts to weigh in on an issue on any given day. I think one thing would change a little bit would to be have a kind of a rotating group of people where it's not the same ones every day. That was one thing that was a bit of a challenge at Arena, but it is definitely on our radar screen, something we'd like to follow up on and pursue.
Well, good to know, and we'll keep checking politics for topics for us to discuss and hopefully have you on again in the future.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks again, David.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, and that was David Mark of politics.topics.com. And remember that when I'm saying that, I'm trying to emphasize the X instead of the C, which is harder to do on the radio than it would be to read, on the Internet. So try to figure that out when you type it in your browser. I have a feeling that there's enough traffic there that it would be one of the first hits on Bing or Google or whatever you choose to use. Well, Tim, do watch the switchboard for me if anything comes in because I'm having internet issues, but luckily I remember the rest of our topics. And we were talking about the DPG. You alluded to, you know, it's really a shame that all these problems are coming up at the same time in which Michelle Nunn's about to announce. And according to Political Wire, she is very close to announcing. I mean, she's decided to run, and this is probably as good a candidate as we can get. Certainly as good a candidate as we can get to not risk anything, if you will. And, Tim, it looks like Catherine's come on in, but I'm not sure I'm going to have the internet access to bring her up. Let me try it. Hey, Catherine Smith, there?
Yes, I am.
Hey,
finally.
That was good, though, because, you know, we talked about you in the first part of the show. And let's just back up since we've got Catherine here. Catherine, you mentioned on Blog for Democracy, you did a lengthy, well-researched post on the DPG's finances. Now, you didn't get into legal aspects of how, Mike Burlon was brought before the Georgia bar and reprimanded, and David Worley has since called for him to step down. But you talked about the money-raising side of things and how bleak the situation's gotten. I actually had to look at your numbers to get myself correct. It's around $31,000 on hand. We were talking about the Alabama Party being broke. How long is it till the Democratic Party of Georgia is about in the same situation?
Well, it can't be long because the cash on hand was about $31,000, but there was also about $18,000 in debt, near-term debt, credit card debt, and bills that need to be paid. According to now, this is the one thing I want to be clear about is that that is the federal. They have a federal account and a state account. I haven't seen the filings for the state account. That was for the federal account, but typically, the federal account is where most of the money goes. So, I mean, there could be a little bit more money, but it's probably not a significant amount. So it's pretty bleak. It is pretty bleak, and they have let a couple people go. Eric, the communications guy, he resigned 2 weeks ago. Friday was his last day, and they let their web guy go a couple weeks ago. And so it's a real skeleton crew. I mean, they were already down a few people anyway, so it's a real skeleton crew. And this is not the best time to be raising money either because, you know, summer, people are not around. And so it looks pretty bleak. But, you know, those things can change. But the rest of the things that are going on don't help with the situation with Representative Tyrone Brooks. You know, all these things sort of add to a pretty bleak outlook.
Catherine.
Well, one thing that you mentioned.
Okay, go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to ask a question. And in the first part of this show, I just came out and said that Mike Furlong needed to resign. And I was just wondering if you had any opinion on that.
Well, you know, I think it was about a year ago that I wrote a blog post about that. You know, I think you're right. You know, I agree with David Worley. I agree with sort of the general idea that, I mean, my feeling is that now is the time. If he's not gonna resign or they're not gonna vote him out now, then it's just gonna get worse and more difficult to do it as we get closer to the 2014 elections.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he goes now, we might have some time to sort of repair things and raise some money and, you know, sort of shore things up before the 2014 elections. But, the clock's ticking, you know, you might say.
Yes.
Well,
that brings up one point I did want to make that you made on your blog post is the Republican Party has 630-some-odd thousand in their account, so that means they have like 20 times as much money, and this is one case where you really want to compare Republicans to Democrats. The next question,
you
talked about voting him out. What's the procedure for voting him out? I mean, I'm trying to think of what is the mechanism, the number of votes you have to get him to step down, or is there a number of votes?
Yeah, there is. The procedure is that the executive committee, which is meeting on June 6th, has to get a two-thirds – I'm pretty sure about this. They have to have a two-thirds vote to they sort of tell him that they're going to have – like it's not a hearing, but it's a – like they inform him that they're going to vote at the next state committee meeting within 30 days, no sooner than 30 days from the time that they tell him that. They can have a state committee meeting, and then they need two-thirds votes from the state committee, so it's about 200 votes.
Okay, and it's a two-step process. You have to get the two-thirds of the executive committee to vote, and then you have to get two-thirds of the state committee to vote. Now, one thing I guess will complicate this is the chair, you know, they have so many appointments they get to make that people might appointed. So I don't know if that's a third or more of the people he got to appoint. And some of them, people, of course, did support him in the past. That means you have to get people to basically – you know, say have a real vote of no confidence on him, people that either he supported or supported him in the past, correct?
Yes.
And then you'd have basically another campaign, if you will. Now, let me ask you this. Let's say, is it a vote where let's say they were to say, you know, that it goes to the state committee, he gets voted out,
and I'm just using this because conjecture, this could be another candidate for that matter, just for the future reference. Well, then, do they immediately hold an election for the chair, or do they have to put an election on the books down the road and have a open campaign?
You know, I'm not sure.
Who runs?
I got to tell you, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it would go to the first vice chair as an interim, I think.
An interim.
I'm pretty sure about that. I'm not 100% sure about the procedure once the vote is made and he is voted. I'm just not sure about how that process works. But I think it would go to an interim chair, which would be the first vice chair, until such time as they can have a vote. I'm not 100% sure.
And the next question I would have. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
Well, and then the next question I would have, if the first vice chair was going to seek the chairmanship or chairship, if you whatever the correct term is, would they then be able to serve? Because, of course, that would give them a bit of advantage, you would think, or maybe disadvantage, depending on how you look at it, for the next election. So it sounds
well,
like no
it
matter what.
Well, it's very complicated after that because, you know, that
yeah.
we do have this gender requirement. So if – so let's say let's just, like, not – talk about the existing people, but we have a male as the chair right now and a female as the vice chair. So then the female is the interim chair. And then I don't know how the next, like, and if the woman vice chair, first vice chair wants to run as the chair, then I guess we have to have an election for. Well, we would have an election for the first vice chair and the chair. And then you'd have to make sure that you're gender balanced because you have to have a male for one and a female for the other.
Well, here's the thing. Let's say we're going to speak to people because that's no secret, Nikeem Williams. Let's say she runs for chair, didn't win. Why would she have to risk her vice chair spot? It seems like she wouldn't have to risk it, if you will. She wouldn't have to vacate that seat. So, therefore, you'd only need the election for vice chair if she were to win. In that case, then, you know, one election turns into the next election. It's kind of like with these folks. One person vacates a county commission seat to seek a state house seat, and that because the state house guy seeking a state senate seat, and, you know, it's just – creates a train.
Right, but I mean, if we're going to follow the same, and I don't know. I haven't looked at the bylaws about this specific situation, and I don't even know if it's addressed, honestly. And I don't think there's a current, I don't know what the most current version of the bylaws is. I know that the one that was posted most recently was actually not the most current because there were some things in there that have happened that are in place that were voted on that are not mentioned in the most recent bylaws that I've seen posted. So I don't know. I mean, this is going to require a great deal of, planning by whoever's going to be running these elections. And our attorney, who I assume would be Mike Jablonski, but I'm not sure who's serving as in that role right now.
Can I jump in with another question?
Go ahead, Tim.
Sure.
When a person of the stature of David Worley says what he says, how much weight would that carry with the executive committee and with the state committee members at large?
Well, you would think that it would be, you know, pretty significant. But, you know, we're Democrats. And, you know, everybody has an opinion and everybody has their reasons for supporting or not supporting. And, I was very surprised to see David Worley be so strident about it. I thought it was, you know, he was very clear and very, I thought, you know, not, he didn't seem to be personal, which I thought was good. You know, he was just talking about the sort of what's best for the party, and I thought that was very thoughtful and carefully spoken. But the state committee and the executive committee are, you know, people keep, you know, a lot of people ask me stuff because I used to serve on both of them. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there it's a funny group of people who have, you know, there's a fair amount of loyalty. And there's also, you know, people that are far away that maybe don't read the AJC every day or,
mm-hmm.
you know, don't have much dealing with the party aside from, you know, the emails that they get or the JJ dinner that they come to or, you know, stuff like that. So they're not as, I mean, they're engaged and they're probably in their local party and they know their representatives and stuff, but they're not as engaged in the party as people who are close by. And I mean, it's just sort of a natural occurrence that the people who are close by are more involved.
David,
so I don't.
Well, and that's the problem with the Democratic Party of Georgia. If people in Augusta, Savannah, Albany, all these different places don't feel like they even know what's going on with the Democratic Party of Georgia, because it's not the Democratic Party of Atlanta. I mean, I live in the Atlanta media market. I don't think Atlanta's that far away. I mean, I can drive down and be down there with a little over an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I know folks that are 3 hours away, but they shouldn't have to feel that disengaged. And if the party, if they feel that disengaged, that's a problem on the part of the party.
I think it's both. I mean, I think there's a certain responsibility if you're elected to serve as in the governing body. You have a little bit of a – I'm not saying that there is a responsibility on both sides, but I think there is a little bit of a responsibility. I mean, on the part of the, you know, state committee member to maintain their involvement. But then again, also, they may do that, but if they're only working directly with the party, then they might not even see any of these things. They, you know, they read the paper and they think, oh, you know, they're just going after Mike. You know, he's the Democrat in charge.
Well,
and,
yeah.
But, I mean, well, I know what's going on, and I haven't been down to Manuel's Tavern or gone to the Red Clay Democrats or wherever the movers and shakers are supposed to hang out. Tim and I know what's going on, and we, you know, that's so.
Yeah, but the first step in this process is going to be David Worley going to the executive committee. This is a far different animal than the state, you know, committee members, you know, in Chattooga County or whatever, casting a vote. You both have sat on that executive committee. You know its makeup. You know its general thinking. How are they going to react to this?
I think it's going to be hard to get two-thirds majority. I think they could get a majority pretty easily, but I think that high bar of two-thirds, consider Mike Burline put a handful of people on the committee, and you have to get them there. That's what people don't understand about a lot of these committee votes. You're never going to have all the people, certainly of the state committee, show up, and probably of the executive committee. For instance, there was an Atlanta City Council person that served on the executive committee for part of the time I did as well, and that person, I'm trying to not give it away, never came in person to a meeting. Sometimes they would call in, and sometimes they were absent, and they lived in the city in which we had the meetings. So it is more difficult than you think to get some of these people there.
And, you know, I'm not 100% sure about that two-thirds for the executive committee. I know that's the case with the state committee. I'm just not – I can't – I don't have a copy of the bylaws because they're not – the current ones aren't posted. But – I'm pretty sure it's definitely a majority. So, and you're right, it's hard to get everybody there, and there's a lot of people that serve on that on the executive committee who are like all the there's a group of people that never show up, like elected officials who maybe don't even know what their role is. And
I'll tell you that probably the angriest I ever was is there was something we had to vote on and I can't even tell you what it was. And they had to have a quorum, and I missed my son's basketball game. I drove down to College Park to a meeting. They rented a hall. They spent good money on it. And people purposely did not come to whatever meeting there was to vote on so that a vote couldn't be held. I wasted hours of my time. Other people did the same thing, missed no time what important to their life just because people decided not to show up. Who's to say that if Mike Burlon thinks that this is how it's going to go, they could somehow have people just not show up. And it's kind of like a pocket veto for group politics. You just make sure
I remember
that
meeting.
And you kick the
I remember
can
that
down
meeting.
The road. Probably the angriest I've ever been. I don't know if which I, or you did you go and waste your time as well?
Yeah, but you know, it wasn't as much, you know, it wasn't that far
yeah.
for me. But that was the meeting where they were like counting the head, doing a head count constantly, and people were coming and going so that the head count never reached quorum. With
yeah,
Bobby Kahn.
And I don't care how you feel about something. We live in a democracy, and you just need to abide by whatever it is whenever the vote's taken. And if you can come, get there. Well, get out questions, because then we got to go. Do you think Mike Burlon is putting himself as more important than the Democratic Party of Georgia? Tim?
I believe he thinks right now that the things he is doing are for the good of the Democratic Party of Georgia, and that his continued presence as chairman of the party is good for the Democratic Party of Georgia. And as I've said earlier, I think at this point he's sadly mistaken.
Catherine?
I think that he is I think he's facing a lot of troubles and isn't looking at things as
yep.
objectively as he as he could, and that you know it's time for him to you know take some time to you know evaluate his role. And I mean, it would be really much easier for everyone if he resigned and didn't make us go through this public process. But, you know, like he said, there's a process. It's a democracy. And if he believes that he's doing right, then he has every right to try to prove that and, you know, go through the process. I wish we didn't have to go through it, though.
Yeah, I tell you what, if you put all of the negative press that Jane Kidd, Bobby Kahn, John Blackmon, David Worley, I guess those are our past four DPG chairs, together, they wouldn't be as what, you know, has been brought up in the past week about Mike Burlon. As far as employees go, I can't tell you if I can even remember a situation which as much negative press was brought up about all the employees combined over the past decade to 15 years has been brought up about Rashad Ritchie and the amount of time spent defending that person. I mean, we've spent so much time. There's been so much time spent on this as opposed to how do we win the Senate seat? How to recruit governor's candidates? How do we defend John Barrow's seat? How do we get more legislators in the House and Senate so the Republicans don't have supermajorities? Instead, we're protecting the jobs and roles at all costs of people at the DPG. Really, at the end of the day, there may not be the money there to pay anybody anyway if there's only, you know, $30,000 left in the bank, not counting debts. And so that's how I see it. Well, thanks again to David Mark of politics.topics.com. We'll be on next week with another Kudzu, Vine. Till then.
Thanks, guys.
Good night, guys.
Good evening.